HW Media. Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein. Welcome to Spy Talk. Some of the biggest news from the war in Ukraine this week comes from the sky. First, there was the collision between a Russian warplane and a U.S. MQ-9 reconnaissance drone. Then came news that Poland was transferring four MiG-29 fighter bombers to Ukraine. Then we learned that a U.S. B-52 strategic bomber flew a very provocative mission along Russian airspace. All this was treated carefully by David Cenciotti, the founding editor of The Aviationist, one of the world's leading chroniclers of military aviation news and analysis. Cenciotti is a former lieutenant in the Italian Air Force, a private pilot, and a graduate in computer engineering. He has written 5 books and contributed to many more. We're happy to have him today on the Spy Talk podcast. David Cenciotti, welcome to Spy Talk. It couldn't be more timely to have you on the show because we have this incident with the MQ-9 Reaper reconnaissance drone flown by the U.S. And a Russian aircraft. Now, from your reporting and other reports, the transponder, the identifying transponder of the MQ-9 was turned off. It's not like the Russians can't see it. So what's the purpose of turning off the transponder?
Let's say that this is almost standard practice for that kind of mission. I mean, there's no need for an ISR, an intelligence surveillance and reconnaissance aircraft to advertise its position to the local radars. Actually, we cannot be completely sure that the transponder was off. I mean, the fact that the aircraft, in this case, the MQ-9, was not tracking live on flyradar24.com or any other flight tracking website or app doesn't mean the transponder was completely turned off. Anyway, if this is the case, meaning that the transponder was turned off, it's this kind of aircraft, these biplanes or drones, operate in due regard, meaning that they separate themselves from other aircraft flying in international airspace, far from busy airports, and so turning off the transponder is pretty much standard practice.
In contrast, you also reported about a very provocative B-52. Nuclear-capable B-52 flying over Russian airspace and up it deep into the Gulf of Finland with its transponders on. It was trying to send a message to the Russians.
Yes. It didn't fly inside the airspace. The Russian sovereign airspace, otherwise that would be a completely different story. It flew through the flight information region, that is to say the area of responsibility of the Russian, in this case of St. Petersburg area control center. So it was still in international airspace, but you're right. They were flying, in that case, it was a single B-52 flying with a transponder turned on. This means that it was a show force. I mean, they were aware
a show of
being,
force
of tracking live on. Yes, a show force. This is not the first time we have seen something like this. It was for certain the first time that a U.S. bomber flew that close to the Russian airspace and to St. Petersburg, but not the first time that we can track it online using flight radar and this kind of websites.
So it didn't fly over Kaliningrad. It flew near Kaliningrad airspace.
Exactly. It skirted the airspace, but it was not within the 12 nautical miles of the territorial waters of Russia, or in this case, Kaliningrad Oblast.
Okay, now, when we first arranged to talk on the podcast, we wanted to talk about the new SR-72 spy plane. Why do we need another new spy plane, given all the satellites and so on? And what's the advantage of this new, or tell us about this new souped up spy plane?
Yeah, we cannot be completely sure it's actually a new one, meaning a recent one, because there's rumors about something existing, probably the SR-72 or something like similar. A replacement, a successor to the retired and pretty famous Lockheed SR-71 Blackbird. This is, the first rumors probably date back to the early 2000s, but in 2013, Lockheed actually announced the fact that they were working on an actual replacement to the Blackbird, called or designated, let's say, SR-72. The need. This is going to be a hypersonic aircraft used both for strike, so it will be able to deliver some kind of ordnance or to carry weapons, and also to perform ISR, to perform a reconnaissance mission.
So to sum up, it's hypersonic. It's going to be much faster and presumably be able to fly higher than other aircraft. But the main thing I took away from what you just said is that it's also going to be able to carry weapons.
Yes. What we know about this project is based on just a few details that have been little by little released by Lockheed and then confirmed by the U.S. Air Force. The details are not that many, but based on what has been provided so far, this is going to be probably an unmanned aircraft.
A what aircraft, please?
An unmanned aircraft, meaning that no pilot could sit inside.
Unmanned, an unmanned aircraft, no pilot.
No pilot. Also able to perform attack missions, strike missions. The need for this is that flying at Mach 6, because this is what the, based on the information that we have as of yet, the aircraft can fly from anywhere more or less in the world and reach a target in around the globe in 1.5 hours.
Wow.
This means that this kind of asset can be suited to perform those kind of mission critical, time critical missions, meaning that if you have a very small window of opportunity to strike or to photograph a target anywhere around the world, you may need an extremely fast aircraft to reach that spot, to penetrate an enemy airspace and get the result you are trying to achieve.
Wow, this is really Dr. Strangelove territory. So, for example, if we detected that the Russians were about to launch an ICBM at the U.S. or Ukraine or so on, we could shoot in an SR-72 to take out that missile before it was even launched. Is that the idea?
Yeah, the idea is this one. The example is perfect. Probably the type of reaction may be a different one to an ICBM launch, an imminent launch of a ballistic missile. But the idea is that one. If something, because satellites are extremely capable, but they are also predictable. So They cannot do. If we think about the reconnaissance part of all the variety of missions that a so-called son of Blackbird can carry out, Strike is one of those, but also reconnaissance mission, and satellites are predictable.
Let me ask you about that. Why do we need an SR-72, a souped-up or son of Blackbird, when we're still flying the U-2s? I'm not sure why the SR-71 was retired when we're still flying the U-2s. So why did we actually need this when we have satellites and U-2s and so on? Is it just because of the speed factor, like you suggest?
Yes, speed is being considered again as a key factor in order to be able to penetrate defend the airspace
and unlike satellites,
satellites are much more predictable.
Meaning you can't, it's not like the movies where you just move a satellite around. In reality,
yes, exactly.
A satellite has a certain orbit that's predictable.
Yeah.
And station,
yes.
And you just can't move it quickly to look at a particular target unless you're very lucky and you happen to be passing over that target. So you need a super fast hypersonic aircraft that can dart into, say, Russia and take pictures and record,
yes,
electronic intelligence over the target.
Yes, yes. I mean, as you mentioned, the fact that a satellite orbit is known also to the enemy means that they can hide from satellites. But if you have a very small window of opportunity to get the picture or to strike a specific target, a hypersonic aircraft can do the job. Because it can reach in 1.5 hours any spot all around the world. And this means that you have something that can penetrate an enemy airspace, get the job done, and return without the enemy air defense being able to counter that threat. And this is the reason why now high speed, hypersonic speed in excess of Mach 5 are being considered as a way to achieve some strategic results, also tactical results in the battlefield.
I used to build plastic warplanes when I was a kid, and if I were still that kid, or maybe kids today, want to build a model of that SR-72. That's a pretty sleek aircraft. Now let's turn to other news on the warplanes front. We're just learning that Poland is going to transfer some MiG-29s to Ukraine, four of them. Is that going to make a difference? What can those MiG-19s do in Ukraine to change the balance of power?
I'm not sure they can change the balance, but for sure they will help the Ukrainian Air Force, and they can make it extremely fast because the Ukrainian already fly the very same aircraft, the MiG-29 Fulcrum.
Yes, I should have said MiG-29, not MiG-19. Sorry.
Go okay.
My,
yeah,
and my bad.
This means that they are they already know how to fly and fight with a MiG-29, and so there will be their time to market. Let's say using their time to be proficient with the new aircraft is immediate. So it will help them because the MiG-29, along with the Su-27, the Flanker, the same type the Russian have used to intercept and bring down the American, the US MQ-9 in the Black Sea, are the backbone of the Ukrainian Air Force. They carry out many types of missions, from the air defense to the SEAD, meaning the suppression of the enemy air defenses, by integrating also some Western-provided weapons, like the AGM-88, high-speed anti-radiation missile, so they can attack enemy radars. And this means that, obviously, with the war going on for more than a year now, they have lost some of their fulcrums. And having four more, for sure, it's like a way for them to replenish their stock and to be able to perform their various missions with additional aircraft.
So to sum up, it'll be used to suppress Russian anti-aircraft and perhaps artillery munitions.
They can attack using that kind of missile. They can attack the radars used by a surface-to-air missile battery to pose a threat to the Ukrainian aircraft. So it's an extremely important type of mission that is carried out in order to create a safe airspace for the Allied aircraft, for other Ukrainian aircraft or to operate. So it's something that is used, it has been integrated last year, and the MiG-29, it's also using, for instance, along with the AGM-88, it's using also the JDAM extended range, meaning a type of
smart bomb.
Precision, yes, a smart bomb with the range in excess of 45 miles because of a kit, a modification kit that you can use on the bomb. So MiG-29 is being in some way upgraded, let's say. It can integrate Western provided weapons, and having four more, for sure, it's better than not having, because there's a war going on, and they've been asking for more aircraft, for more jets since the beginning of the war. So
can you foresee air-to-air combat, like what we call dogfights between the Russian and Ukrainian jets?
We have seen something happening already every now and then. This is not too often, I mean, but because the tactic is especially for the Ukrainians to try to avoid getting in a dogfight or being engaged from long distance by capable Su-35 or, I mean, the most advanced the Russian aircraft, but it may happen. So we have seen some footage coming from Ukraine showing some engagement. So this is something that can always happen.
Well, we've seen the general picture has been that the Ukrainians have outmaneuvered, outfought the Russians, that the Russians are slow to maneuver, slow to react, slow using strategies that have not been effective against the Ukrainians. So the Ukrainians are far weaker power with far less manpower and so on, have been able to outsmart the Russians. Do you think that will, or have we seen evidence of that in the sky as well, of Ukrainian pilots outsmarting the Russian pilots?
Oh, in general, what we have seen, we were not expecting probably in the beginning the Ukrainian forces to resist and also to be able to react to the invasion and to fight in the same way that we are seeing. And this it's something that can be safely said also for what deals with the Ukrainian Air Force, with the aviation segment of the war, let's call it this way. So I think that what we have seen is that using alternate airfields, using specific tactics, also leveraging the training and the integration work that has been done in the previous years with NATO and the Western air forces has helped a lot the Ukrainian force to survive, and also to do something more, that is to be able to strike back in many cases. Probably many analysts in the beginning were anticipating a fall of Ukraine in a matter of a few days, and we are more than 1 year later seeing that the balance of power is not reflected in the battlefield, where the Ukrainians are still able to resist and also to achieve some important wins.
Well, we have to take a short break here for our sponsors. Be back in a second. Okay, we're back now with David Cenciotti of The Aviationist. How is the United States aiding, or NATO in general, but particularly we're interested in the United States, aiding the Ukrainian Air Force maneuvers and strategies? Do we have Americans teaching the pilots new tricks, or installing new software in the Ukrainian aircraft, or helping direct Ukrainian airstrikes? Is there deep American involvement?
This is something that's being debated a lot. I mean, there probably something, it's happening, but this is the extent of the of this the support that is being provided is not clear. I mean, it's not it's something that is kept quite. They are keeping a low profile.
Low profile. Okay. Of course, the United States has given Poland a lot of military aid, and it's quite possible that the Polish are transferring technology and training that they got from the United States to Ukrainian pilots and other parts of the Ukrainian Air Force.
Well, what they are doing for sure, NATO is giving... and all the partners, including the US, all the allies, are providing a lot of weaponry. This is this means that the AGM-88 kind of missile that I mentioned earlier, the JDAM ER extended range that I mentioned previously, those are weapons that have been provided. There's been a lot of talk in the past few weeks about providing the Abrahams tanks. There's a lot. I mean, that is something that is public, that is being discussed, announced. It's somehow on paper. There are other things that have been, in some cases, suggested. I mean, there's someone who suggested the U.S. or, generally speaking, NATO can share some intelligence data with the Ukrainian that may have helped in the past the Ukrainians to carry out some particularly daring attacks or some particular actions in the battlefield. That part is something that... let's say has not been proven, but it's something that it's possible. I mean, there must be a way. There's probably something in progress in terms of sharing intelligence data with the Ukrainian in order to help them. Even though this is something that I mean, it's done secretly probably, and this is something that is more difficult for us to get a clear picture of.
Do the Ukrainians have the kind of aircraft, his name escapes me for the moment, but the kind of aircraft that flies above the battle and coordinates all the warplanes during an attack? Do the Ukrainians have anything like that?
No, they haven't. They haven't. All the most valuable ISR or airborne early warning aircraft that you can see on flight tracking websites, for instance, or you may have heard of, these are all NATO aircraft. They operate close to the border, but not inside Ukraine. They can gather data, they can have intelligence about what is happening, and that's the reason why they fly there, to look at the airspace, but also to have a clear picture of the enemy order of battle, as it's called. But this is something that is done from the NATO airspace, not inside Ukrainian. The point is that someone suggested some of that intelligence may be shared with the Ukrainians. Seems like likely, even though we don't have clear evidence or details about this.
So NATO aircraft, surveillance intelligence aircraft can fly around Ukraine and off Russia and take readings on Air Force, Russian Air Force positions and flight patterns and so on, and can relay that intelligence to the Ukrainians so they know where the Russians are and when they're coming, where they're coming from.
Yeah, this is something that, something that is possible, even though this has never been officially confirmed, as far as I remember. I mean, this kind of cooperation is probably being done, being in place, is something that is, has been implemented, let's say, but we have no clear details of what is really happening. So this is something that is difficult for us to confirm.
Okay.
But seems like likely.
And finally, one of the reasons that the United States has been reluctant to supply the Ukrainians with F-16s is that we fear that the Ukrainians might fly over the border into Russia and carry out airstrikes in Russia and embroil NATO in a direct conflict with the Russians. Do you worry that the Ukrainians will use these new MiG-29s to carry out airstrikes in Russia? And what would prevent them from doing that? I mean, the Ukrainians have not been shy about saying they want to take the battle to the Russians. What would stop them from carrying out airstrikes in Russia?
Actually, almost nothing. I mean, there have been actions done beyond the borders, counterattacks done with helicopters, with gunship helicopters, for instance. So I think that this is a scenario that we still need to consider, the possibility for an aircraft, a fixed wing aircraft or a rotary wing aircraft like an Mi-24, to go to carry out some kind of action outside the Ukrainian airspace, inside the Russian one. Because this is, I think that probably this is not going to lead to a real escalation for the moment, but this kind of threat is existing. And the reason why we have seen anti-aircraft batteries appearing on the rooftops of some Moscow buildings is the reason, it's just because of that, because using drones, using helicopters, obviously helicopters probably will never reach Moscow taking off from Ukraine. But in generally speaking, the ability to carry out long-range raids, airstrikes with drones or other kind of aircraft, this is something that is part of the conflict now. So this is something that we need to consider. So I'm not sure this can lead at the moment to an escalation. That, and what I've seen, generally speaking, is that the US have done all what is possible in order to prevent any kind of escalation. They have been quite clear in terms of, for instance, not enforcing a no-fly zone so that no NATO aircraft or no US aircraft is flying inside the Ukrainian and possibly clashes with the Russian one directly, even though we have seen that an actual clash has involved an MQ-9 and Su-27 off Crimea in international airspace. But this is the what I have observed so far, the attempt to prevent in any way any kind of escalation. So they are keeping the relationship there. They are still contacting themselves so that nothing can lead to a real escalation of the war beyond what we are already seeing now, because there's war in Europe. And this is something that has been going on for 1 year now.
And yet we are one step closer to an open conflict with the Russians and NATO. Kind of thing that keeps you up late at night, makes you twist and turn in your bed.
Yeah.
Well, David, thank you so much for coming on the Spy Talk podcast. We really, really appreciate your expertise. You're the top gun, you might say, in aviation journalism. And we're happy to have you. Thank you.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having you in your podcast.
That's it for Spy Talk this week. Hope you've enjoyed it, and we love hearing from you. So don't hesitate to leave a comment wherever you're hearing this. Also, if you haven't already done it, wander over to the Spy Talk newsletter on the Substack platform for more coverage of this and other intelligence-related issues. Just Google Spy Talk and my name, and it'll pop up there. Until next time, I'm Jeff Stein. Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to SpyTalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.